This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in. Coming up, Don Glass, host of WFIU's A Moment of Science, joins me to talk about his new book, How the World Looks to a Bee and Other Moments of Science. We'll talk about his radio feature that's been on the air for over 30 years. And later, the director of the Center for Loss and Life Transition joins me to talk about dealing with the feeling of grief that's come over a lot of people since the onset of the pandemic. But first, we kick off the Friday pitch-in with a recap of Indiana's week that was with the shining star of our digital team, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
The shining star.
You're a shining star, no matter who you are.
How's it going, Matt?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing just fine. But we, like we have been getting at noon every day, we have an update on the numbers from the COVID-19 pandemic. What does it look like right now?
Yeah. So as of noon, 1,791 people have died from COVID-19. There are more than 30,000 confirmed cases. We actually crossed that threshold today. And more than 208,000 Hoosiers have been tested so far. So comparing that to last week, we had just reached 1,500 deaths. We had more than 26,000 confirmed cases and more than 165 tests. So testing is continuing to grow. And along with that, confirmed cases and deaths as well.
165,000 tests. So quite a few more tests this week. Of course, along those lines, stage three of the state's plan to reopen, did it start today?
Yes. Began.
Is that a couple days early?
Yes. So originally it was supposed to set to begin on May 24th, which was which is Sunday. But the governor announced Wednesday that he would start stage three today for all but Marion, Lake and Cass counties, with an amendment that if local or county government says you can't start, then that supersedes the governor's executive order. He's still highlighting local control, but using the state as the roadmap. So if local government or county government wants to be more stringent, then they can. But what stage three means is it allows gyms, fitness centers, community pools, campgrounds to open within social distancing restrictions and sanitation guidelines. So the governor pushed back reopening a few things in the executive order he signed yesterday, specifically movie theaters and playgrounds. Movie theaters won't open until stage four, and playgrounds have yet to be determined when those will open. And Governor Holcomb also extended a ban on utility shutoffs, foreclosures, and evictions through July 1st.
Okay, so some good news for people who maybe want to get out and celebrate Memorial Day weekend, because the campgrounds reopening is kind of a surprising thing. Actually, my wife and I, we're going on vacation next week. The show is on vacation, and we're planning on hitting up an Indiana State Park campground this weekend. Mm-hmm. So that's good news. Gyms and fitness centers, community pools reopening as well, all of that. And so stage three beginning now and stage four still set to begin in July.
Mm-hmm. Mid-June.
Oh, okay. Yeah. 10-4. And what about this? So we did a show about this yesterday, the Workshare program. Mm-hmm. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce has commented on this. First of all, do we know, do you have an explanation for what a Workshare program is?
Yeah, I think the simplest way is that Workshare programs basically allow companies to have employees work reduced hours while the unemployment system supplements the difference in pay. So it just allows companies to keep their employers without hurting their ability to have supplemental income due to those reduced hours.
That is a great, concise description of what a Workshare program is. We did an entire hour on this yesterday, and I would encourage you, if you're curious about this topic, to check that out. And it was difficult to understand some of the opposition to Workshare programs, but there is opposition out there to Workshare programs, and it seems like Indiana is not quite ready to make the jump into a Workshare program right now. What does the Indiana Chamber of Commerce say?
Yeah, they're basically just saying it's disappointed the governor's office hasn't decided to implement a work-share program. The federal government made it a little bit easier for states to do that. And in fact, 28 states now have work-share programs, some even, in fact, starting during the pandemic. There's money in the CARES Act to make that a little bit easier. And then last Friday, Governor Eric Holcomb said his office has researched system updates and whether there was legislative support. But said that there are no immediate plans to start one. Previous session, bills were authored in both the House and Senate to implement a program, but neither received an initial committee hearing, which that sentence actually says quite a bit. It just means that for the committees that run, or for the majority party, essentially caucuses just don't have the support to get it off the ground. And they weren't interested in hearing it last year. They didn't think it was going to be a big enough topic in order to tackle in a short session.
And the Indiana Manufacturers Association has shared that they oppose the idea of a work share program. And so they may be part of the influence here. And yes, indeed, I would encourage you to check out the show that we did on that yesterday. We welcomed four great guests on the topic. And it is it's an interesting one, to be sure. I had not heard of these programs. And indeed, more than half of U.S. states have them on the books, with two more coming on during the pandemic. So it is an interesting topic, for sure. Perhaps one that will be readdressed in the next session. Has anyone said anything about that?
No, not so far. And the fact that the governor's office said he was looking into legislative support maybe makes me think that he's dipping a toe. There's next legislative session. It might as well be on Mars for how little we are going to be able to know about it, right?
This is for sure, yeah.
The only thing that we do know is that teacher pay is still going to be a huge issue, and mostly because of how I imagine education funding might be seeing cuts. For the governor's press conference I'm covering a little bit later this afternoon, they're already talking about what state government has already done to make up for the shortfalls in revenue. So that's going to be a huge focus. I don't know if Workshare is going to rise to the top or not.
And part of what we talked about on the show yesterday, I believe the analogy, it's like drinking from a fire hose was used. I mean, these groups, you know, DWD and the governor and the legislature, they have so much going on right now anyway. And so to add one more thing, maybe that's part of why they're not considering this right now. But there is a lot of talk about it right now, which is interesting for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some COVID cancellations to talk about. What's the big one?
The big one, well, okay, so it's big to me because I'm in Indianapolis and because I'm a nerd. Gen Con is super canceled, guys. Gen Con President David Hopp said it's not feasible to host an in-person tabletop gaming convention while also maintaining social distancing. The convention has drawn about 70,000 people in recent years, and they decided it wasn't safe, which is a blow to small businesses that rely on that convention. But Gen Con is planning virtual events to try and make up for the cancellation.
Have you ever used Tabletop Simulator on the computer?
Okay, so no.
No? Okay, so I've been to Gen Con several times myself.
Mm-hmm.
It has gotten really, really crowded over the last few years, which is promising to me, but I you know, it's just a lot of people in one space.
Yeah.
And so I have missed the last couple of years, and, you know, I'm also a parent now, and so that sucks up a lot of my time. But Tabletop Simulator, it's a lot of fun, and you can do campaigns there and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You're a D&D player, right?
Well, I'm a full-blown DM. I'm a dungeon master. It has been a long time since I've played as a player, but it's been hard enough trying to figure out how to navigate getting everyone together to do something like that, and then just having the mental bandwidth to write chapters of or write a session for the campaign as well.
Mm. Well, there have been other cancellations as well, or potential cancellations, it sounds like. What else?
Yeah, so local and county fairs are also making decisions on canceling right now. The Monroe County has canceled its fair, though it's currently trying to figure out how to allow 4-H kids to showcase their work. And a number of county fairs, including Owen and Hancock and Bartholomew counties, are showcasing 4-H work, but won't have food or rides. So there's a little bit of a squishiness to, like, is the fair actually canceled? I mean, yeah, technically, but it's still being held in order to showcase the work of folks who participate in 4-H competitions.
Yeah, it's an extremely limited celebration or get-together, it seems like, this year, which is probably a good idea.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the challenger to Curtis Hill that emerged this week. Well, two things happened this week, actually.
Yeah.
Let's get to the first one.
Yeah, decidedly not COVID-19 news. The first one, four Indianapolis residents have filed a lawsuit trying to get Attorney General Curtis Hill permanently ousted from his position. The complaint filed in Marion County wants the state Supreme Court to answer the question it refused to answer earlier this week, whether or not the 30-day suspension of Hill's law license creates a vacancy in the office. And basically what the lawsuit is trying to finagle is if it is a vacancy, then Governor Holcomb is allowed to assign or appoint somebody new to that position, and that could permanently remove Curtis Hill. Holcomb has said on a number of occasions that Hill should have resigned after the allegations became public, and hasn't really stopped that kind of conversation since.
Okay, and a challenger emerges in the Republican Party to Curtis Hill's seat as Attorney General. Who was that?
Yeah, it is former Secretary of State and former U.S. Representative Todd Rokita. He's a familiar face in the Indiana Republican Party. He's been a major figure, in fact, for nearly two decades. He served 8 years as Secretary of State before becoming a four-term congressman. And he left his seat in 2018, actually, for an unsuccessful Senate bid. In a statement, Rokita says he's the only GOP candidate for Attorney General to win two statewide elections. And he says while he normally wouldn't run against a Republican incumbent, he calls current Attorney General Curtis Hill wounded by these allegations.
Mm, ouch. Okay. So I wouldn't say infighting, perhaps, but a challenger, indeed, against Curtis Hill
and he's the,
in Todd Rokita.
Yeah, he's the third challenger, or technically fourth, but third still in it for Curtis Hill. So that'll be—
But certainly, is he the highest profile, would you say?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Definitely the highest profile.
Okay. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Let's face it, if we got everyone together to play, you'd be the Dungeon Master and we'd all have a great time.
Oh, absolutely.
Lauren, we're on vacation next week, so we'll hear from you in 2 weeks.
Sounds good.
Up next, WFIU's A Moment of Science has emanated from Bloomington for over 30 years, and host Don Glass has a new book out. We'll talk to him about the radio vignette's origin, and we'll hear a few of his favorites. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. For decades, public radio listeners have enjoyed A Moment of Science, which is produced out of WFIU in Bloomington on the campus of Indiana University. The daily two-minute vignettes have given curious listeners a window into some of the most fascinating scientific facts. Host Don Glass has been involved since the beginning and has just released a new book of some of the program's best moments. The book, How the World Looks to a Bee and Other Moments of Science, came out in March from IU Press. Don Glass, welcome.
Well, thank you, Matt. Glad to be here.
So for listeners who might not be familiar, I'm going to play one right now. This is one that's featured in the book, and it's one we can all relate to. It's called Smell the Past.
When you step outside and sense the transition from autumn to winter, or notice signals of a fast approaching spring, you likely experience a feeling of being transported back in time and place. Perhaps childhood memories of shoveling snow or kindling a campfire resurface with vivid intensity. Sensory stimuli have the power to involuntarily trigger such memories. Olfactory stimuli, or cues we detect through smell, are special because they activate parts of your brain that spark memories that are often acutely emotional. A good way to comprehend this phenomenon and also learn more about your own memories is to understand how anatomical pathways process olfactory stimuli. After a smell enters the nose, a neural structure called the olfactory bulb relays this odor information to the brain. The information travels through two cerebral regions, the amygdala and the hippocampus, which deal with emotion and memory, respectively. However, auditory, visual, and tactile information do not take this route to the brain, which means information from these senses is less likely to induce feelings of being taken back or revisiting a past emotional state. As we learn more about what happens when smell stimulates memory, it becomes clearer that such memories are likely to be emotionally charged. On one hand, odor-evoked memories increase temporal lobe activity, which has been linked with positive memory processing, thus creating more pleasant experiences than memories brought on by visual cues. On the other hand, people living with PTSD may experience certain smells as potent triggers that can, without warning, shuttle them back to a moment of trauma. What might your recollection of certain odors tell you about your past? This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University. I'm Don Glass.
Don, see, this is why I love these so much. I know that if I ever, for instance, smelled the kind of floor wax they used in my elementary school ever again, it would take me right back to that time. So I'm sure every episode is different in its inspiration. But what, I guess, is a typical example of how one gets started? Like for this one, was it just the question, why are smells tied to memory, or what was it?
Yeah, I have about four or five researcher writers who come up with ideas, and they send them to me. And this was one of the writer's ideas, and I could really relate to that because the same thing happens to me. I mean, things from my childhood, and let's say I'm not young, so 8 or 9 years old. Smells that if I can count those now, I mean, it's just incredible how it sends me back. And I particularly like things like that, programs that people can really relate to in their own lives. Not everything is that directly relatable, but we want them to be able to relate in some way, even if it's finding life on another planet. You can kind of relate to that, I guess, in some sort of extended way. So that's kind of the way it works. We really want people to hear things and say, wow, I didn't know that. That's neat. If people have that reaction to a program, then I think we've achieved our goal. And with that smells and memories program, I think people can really do it. I think probably everybody can do that.
How often do other people have ideas for the show? You produce it at the IU campus. Do you ever get emails or calls from professors saying, hey, you know, make a good Moment of Science?
Yeah, we do. And most of the ideas come from me and the writers, but we do get suggestions from people who hear the program or read it on the web or faculty members who've consulted on programs. Incidentally, just as an aside before we go any farther, every program we do is reviewed by a scientist in that area because we really want it to be right. And there still can be mistakes. I mean, one scientist might have an opinion about something that doesn't agree with another scientist, when that's the way it goes in science. But nevertheless, we're really careful to try to make things as accurate as possible.
Do you have an example of that off the top of your head where there was some sort of contradiction in perhaps something that was minute, but you had to make a decision on which one to run?
Yes, but I can't remember specifically which one that was. It was so controversial among the scientists that we said, well, maybe it's best just not to do this one at this time. But that happens really rarely.
Yeah.
And we've got over 4,000 programs in our archive. So that's a pretty good record, I would say.
Gosh, I would say so. All right, let's hear another one. This is one that I actually hadn't wondered about until I actually heard the episode. This is, what is the difference between horns and antlers?
Today's Moment of Science is all about animal headgear.
That's right. We're talking about horns and antlers.
And how to tell them apart.
Horns and antlers have some important things in common. They both grow from an animal's forehead and are used to assert dominance, provide defense, and attract mates.
It can be easy to mix them up, but today we're going to give you some simple ways to remember which is which.
Here we go.
First of all, look is important. Horns look like daggers, sometimes twisted into exotic shapes.
Antlers look like branches with multiple points.
Second, different types of animals sport different types of headgear. Horns belong to the bovids, animals such as sheep, goats, cows, and bison.
Antlers belong to the cervids. That includes all deer, elk, moose, and caribou, or reindeer.
Number three, horns are made of keratin, just like your fingernails, which means that they grow throughout an animal's whole life and never fall off.
Antlers, on the other hand, are made of bone. They fall off every year in winter or early spring, and a whole new set grows in time for mating season in the fall.
Which brings us to our last big difference. Horns, you see, usually grow on both the male and female members of a species.
While antlers belong almost exclusively to the boys, female caribou are the only exception, and their antlers are pretty small.
So there you have it. Horns versus antlers. Just remember, daggers
versus branches,
bovids
versus cervids,
keratin
versus bone,
both sexes
versus just the guys.
You'll never mix them up again.
So this is another one that's featured in the new book, How the World Looks to a Bee. What would you say was your criteria for which ones went into the book or a book?
Well, that's I don't want to say it's just programs I liked, but that's part of it.
Sure, why not?
But that's not all of it. I mean, I wanted to put programs into the book that, again, I thought people could relate to pretty well. And I think this one, although one would think, well, that's kind of esoteric. Well, it's not really. Let me, as an example, say one of the other things I do in my life is volunteer as an interpretive naturalist at Brown County State Park. And in leading hikes, we'll see signs that deer have been around, one thing or another. And I always like to ask people, what's the difference between horns and antlers? Because, well, I just think it's important. And
sure.
When we're on a nature hike, maybe not in real life, so to speak, but on a nature hike, most times people don't know the difference. So I think they feel pretty enlightened after the difference is explained to them.
And I mean, this isn't the first Moment of Science book you've edited. How many books?
There are two more.
Okay.
They're from way back in the 90s. It's been a while since we've done one.
Yeah. And why the big stretch of time?
I'm not sure. This one was motivated by the fact that the IU Press contacted me and said, it's been a long time since we've done the book, so why don't we do another one? I mean, who knows why there's a big lapse in time, but there was.
Well, the show's been on for over 30 years now, but I feel like I have to ask, how did it get started? What was that germ?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. I'd like to take credit for it, but I can't. I participated in the start of it. I was the program director at WFIU at the time, and so I approved it. But a physics professor who was coming home from a fishing trip with his son was listening to the program called Stardate, which is an astronomy program from the University of Texas. And I think his son said, oh, if that can be done with astronomy, why can't it be done with general science? So Paul Singh, the professor, the late professor who was on the physics faculty at the time, came to me and suggested this. And I said, okay, let's give it a try. Well, and as they say, it's now kind of corny, I guess, and the rest is history.
Or science, as it were.
Oh, yeah.
What about the process of getting them done? I mean, this is a daily show, 5 fresh episodes a week, writing plus fact-checking, then recording, editing. How does it get done?
Well, I'll try to do this quickly. The writers, mainly, it's like this. The writers come up with ideas, send them to me, and I go through them and say, well, number one, has this been done before? If it's been done exactly that way, we won't repeat it. But as with science, and in 2 minutes, you can't say everything about something. We can take the same topic and take a different tack. So I approve the topics. The writers do the research and write them. They send it to a scientist for vetting, as they say. And it comes back and if changes need to be made, they're made and they're sent to me. And we record 6 programs a week. We go in with 1 recording session and do 6 of them. And we get a certain number of them, then we'll package them, then put them onto our website and send them up as podcasts for people to get to when they want.
So let's hear another one. And all I'll say about this one is that it just really put my mind at ease. This one's called Wrong Name.
If you're a parent with more than one child, you probably sometimes mix up your kids' names, calling your daughter by your son's name, for example.
Or even if you're not a parent, You might remember your parents mixing up your name with your brother or sister.
So why do parents do that?
First, to be clear, a parent getting a kid's name wrong has nothing to do with how much the parent loves the child. Mixing up names is a common phenomenon that's caused by how our brains store and recall familiar names.
Researchers at Duke looked into this issue by surveying more than 1,700 people of ages ranging from college students to grandparents. And they found some common threads among subjects who had either been called by the wrong name or who called others by the wrong name.
They found that people tend to confuse names within relationship groups such as children, grandchildren, friends, and siblings. But the mix-ups only occurred within each group. They didn't cross between groups. So, for example, while it's pretty common for a parent to confuse their kids' names, parents almost never confuse their children's names with the names of their friends.
Why does this happen? Because, the researchers say, related concepts prime each other. Mention, think of a pencil, and you're likely to also think of a pen. The same principle applies to familiar names.
In case you're wondering, age-related memory decline doesn't seem to be a factor. College students were just as likely to confuse names as grandparents.
Don, I'm the father of two boys. I also have two dogs that are boys, and all four names have come out incorrectly on multiple occasions, and it's made me worried that I'm losing my mind.
No, I guess you're not.
I'm not now that I've heard that. So how often has the knowledge you've uncovered in producing this show put you at ease?
Well, in that particular case, it hasn't put me at ease at all because I was an only child. But my wife experiences it. She, in fact, does it with her brothers, calls one by the other's name and that sort of thing. People just get used to it, I think.
But it put me at ease because it made me realize that I'm not losing it, I guess. And so science has that quality to it, doesn't it? I mean, the more you know, the less you fear, that kind of thing. But, I mean, it can do the opposite as well. Have you ever uncovered something that made you worry a little bit more?
Well, absolutely, especially programs we've done and more fairly recently on the environment. Mm. I mean, we worry about that enough as it is, but as we do shows about the melting of the Arctic ice caps and that sort of thing, we say, man, we've got to do something about this.
Yeah, science can be scary too. Okay, one more. And again, all of these that we've heard today have been reformatted for print and are featured in the book.
Sorry, wrong number on this moment of science. When speaking on the telephone, we often run into trouble with particular words that, in face-to-face conversations, aren't troublesome at all. Words such as feeling and ceiling seem especially hard to get across the line or to understand when listening to someone else. Is there a reason for this? In fact, there are several reasons, a major one being that telephones completely remove any visual cues from the process of communication. Not only do we read emotional content off the posture of a speaker's body and face, but language comprehension is aided by a subtle form of lip reading. This has nothing to do with speech or hearing impairments. Everyone lip reads for cues during face-to-face conversation, such as the shape of the lips in producing the F sound and not the S sound. A second reason F and S are so troublesome in phone conversations is that they occur at slightly higher frequencies than telephones are built to transmit. That means the phone simply cuts off the high end of the sound you're trying to produce, making it that much harder to distinguish. In a sense, telephones replicate the hearing loss that comes naturally with age. Older people also experience an increasing inability to distinguish the high end of frequencies, making it harder and harder as the years go by to understand other folks' words. So there may be a beneficial side to all this. A young person on the phone can get at least some sense of the frustration an older person may experience every day.
All right, so sorry, wrong number. And that's one I hadn't really thought about, but it's one that, you know, it makes sense, I guess, as people get older, which kind of leads me to this question. Don, when did you retire from WFIU?
You know, it's funny. I think it was around 2004, 2005. You think, well, that's kind of a major milestone in someone's career. Why can't you remember that? Well, the reason is when I actually retired from working full time at WFIU, I continued to do a moment of science. So it's kind of blurred, but it's been about 15 years or so, I guess.
Yeah. So what's that been like? Do you just go in one day a week and record the episodes, or are you just kind of popping in and out whenever you please? You've got a tenure there for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, yes, I'd go in once a week to do the recording with Yael Cassander and our engineer, Mike Paskash. So I do everything else from home, as quite frankly, a lot of people are doing now for different reason.
Yeah.
But even then, I was able to do all of this from home and have been doing it since I retired from being full time.
Yeah. As you say, I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic right now. What's the status of the show these days? Are you still going in to record? I would imagine not.
No, I'm not. And a matter of fact, we've had enough. We record a couple of months in advance. So we've got shows that take us up through about the 26th of May. After that, then we're going to have to dip into the archives if we aren't able to go back into recording. So, and I don't think we will be. So that's where we stand right now. Fortunately, we're more fortunate than a lot of programs. We've got this huge archive that we can dip into for keeping the program going.
Any plans at all to at least step away? I mean, the show is not going anywhere for sure.
No, as long as I still enjoy doing it and FIU wants to continue to produce it, that's the way it'll be.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Don Glass is the host of A Moment of Science, which is produced at WFIU. He's also the editor of the new book, How the World Looks to a Bee and Other Moments of Science, which is available now. Don Glass, thanks for the show and thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And up next, some say the sadness many of us have felt during the pandemic is a form of grief from the loss of the way things were. We'll talk with the director of the Center for Loss and Life Transition about how we can better deal with those feelings, and we'll learn how people from North America accept loss differently from the rest of the world. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're headed into a long holiday weekend, but this year, it just doesn't seem the same, does it? If you're experiencing some sadness or longing for the way things were, it's normal, and you're definitely not alone. And many, including my guest, would say we're experiencing something closer to grief. We're joined by grief counselor Alan Wolfelt, a former Hoosier and the director of the Center for Loss and Life Transition in Fort Collins, Colorado. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
I'm more than happy to do so. Thank you for having me.
You say that this moment has, in fact, given a rise to a grief pandemic. What do you mean by that?
Well, that everybody's been talking, of course, about the physical manifestations of the pandemic, but I've done some writing and reflecting on the fact that we're surrounded by grief in a variety of ways that relate to what we're experiencing. I often say that if you name something right now that you care about that gives your life meaning and purpose, it's in all likelihood that something that is impacting you in a negative way, whether that's your distancing from family and friends to the very real reality of financial losses that people are experiencing. But most profoundly, it's the very real personal losses of family and friends that many people are encountering. But there's a variety of ways that I would reflect on how there's this ripple effect into our lives, ranging again from the very real reality of many people being impacted by the death of family members and friends to social distancing, to personal events that have been canceled, to public activities, experiences that usually bring us together that we cannot do right now, to workplaces shutting down, people moving from work to their home environment, which is quite unique and different for many people. The list goes on and on in terms of the things that often infuse meaning and purpose in our life. And so we're faced with the need to take our grief, which is our internal thoughts and feelings, and openly acknowledge and do what we call mourning. Mourning's the shared response to loss. It's grief gone public. And that's challenged right now because people are more isolated. So many people are at risk for grieving how they're being impacted, but not mourning. Critically important distinction for people to aware of is how you integrate losses into your life is through active, authentic mourning. Not always easy to do in our culture, but something right now that we're just faced with the need to acknowledge that reality.
Well, I think a lot of us associate grief with death, but it sounds to me like the definition's a lot broader than that.
Very much so, Matt, that right now, you know, anything that you attach to, that you experience the loss of, you know, we can think of a much broader framework of loss than just the death of somebody. That's the one that naturally people think of, and that's why many people have not recognized in part what it is they're experiencing is really grief. And the more you can name that and give emotions motion and acknowledge the reality of that, the better served you're going to be. I've created a framework where there's actually six needs we have right now as humans as we're faced with this pandemic of grief. And if you'd like, I can walk you down through those.
Yeah, I would love to. I've six needs. Here we go.
Sure. If you can identify those needs and actively work on them and kind of do what I call befriend them, it helps you integrate what you're experiencing into your life. And so among those are one, the need to one, acknowledge the reality of the pandemic as well as your grief. So first, ensure that you're accurately informed about the virus and measures that you could be taking and should be taking to keep yourself and others as safe as possible. There's a lot of misinformation out there, so go to factual sources and then acknowledge the reality of your grief about the pandemic. Secondly, honor all your feelings. It's common to experience a wide range of emotions with this grief we're facing, if you will, and those can range from disorientation to protest emotions to regret review to, of course, the hallmark of grief is feelings of sadness. But the more you can name your feelings and honor those feelings, the more you can integrate again the reality into your life. Thirdly, practice gratitude for the good that's in your life. To me, now is an essential time to be mindful of the good in your life, that sometimes we can get, you know, dark and light out of balance. And right now, of course, there's a lot of natural darkness, but we've got to remember that out of darkness comes light and to see what you have gratitude for and what's going to help you foster hope. So a fourth one I've written and talked about is, you know, the need to be self-compassionate or be kind to yourself. This grief needs, it deserves our tender, our loving care, if you will. So make a good commitment to take care of yourself in five realms: physically, cognitively, emotionally, socially, and spiritually. A fifth need is to kind of search for meaning. Whenever we're faced with grief and loss, it kind of invites us into what I like to write about as liminal space, where you're betwixt and between. You're kind of suspended between a past for which you hope and hope to return into your life. But you're suspended, and so when you're suspended, you naturally go on a search. I always say those who do not search often do not find. So if you're asking yourself things like why questions, why now, why this way, don't shame yourself for that. Recognize that that's in fact what you're doing, is you've lost meaning in your life secondary to this, and now you're on a search. And then a sixth need is to reach out for support from others. You know, mourning by definition is the shared response to loss. It's grief gone public. So the challenge some people have right now in this isolation time in their lives is in fact being over exiled to the point that they're grieving, but they don't have that social context to mourn. So even during periods of isolation, we as human beings need personal contact. So encourage people to use this difficult time to talk openly and honestly with people you do have access to in your home, or to communicate with others through video calls or emails or texts or do something to keep you in touch with those outside yourself. So those essentially in my mind are six needs that if people are conscious of can help them kind of keep some balance at a time when our lives are out of balance right now, quite naturally.
We talk about the stages of grief as well, which a lot of people are familiar with the kind of grief that we're kind of all feeling right now in the midst of all of this, I guess we could say. Do those stages come in the same order, or is this different somehow?
No, while we owe a debt to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who back in 1969 wrote that classic book on death and dying, a misconception of grief is it's orderly, predictable, and stage-like. It's anything but that. It's kind of like waves coming in off the ocean. Sometimes it's small and tolerable, and sometimes when you least suspect it, a huge wave comes along, maybe even a tsunami, and pulls you off your feet. So while it's in theory, a helpful concept to say, well, there's these dimensions, a term I much prefer to stages, because stages still denote order and prediction. Actually, before her death, she sat up and said, I wish I'd never used the word stages with these Americans. Because again, what happened is we became grief busters. We went around and started prescribing to people what it was they're going to experience. And she talked about, in theory, based on observing 198 people who were actively dying, the five stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Well, there's much more to grief than that, but we, again, want to be reminded we owe her a debt, because she finally got North Americans, who aren't real good at talking about loss and grief, to talk about it. But I warn your audience of listeners out there, don't prescribe to others what they're experiencing. Use a teach me philosophy and be familiar with a variety of ways that grief impacts us, and then be responsively supportive in response to people's needs. So if somebody's shocky or disoriented or protesty or regret review or sadness, whatever it may be, let them teach you. The true expert is the person walking through the experience. Hopefully that's helpful to folks. But you're right, there's a lot of people who are familiar with, quote, stages of grief. Think of dimensions as opposed to stages, and don't think of them as orderly, predictable, or stage-like.
Can you also explain what it means to experience anticipatory grief and how that might apply in our lives right now?
Well, sure. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the concept of anticipatory grief, in that some people think, well, if I've anticipated the loss when I experience it, I'm done. But, you know, you're never really ready. That's intellectual preparation. But the context of what we're experiencing right now, you know, we're anticipating the potential of additional losses. Are we ever going to be able to return to work? Is someone in my life that I care about going to die? What about my own health? So anytime you anticipate potential grief and the need to mourn entering into your life, that's what formally gets called anticipatory grief.
And how, I guess, how much does the lack of a finite end date around the pandemic impact the way that we're able to process it? I mean, oftentimes one of the hallmarks of loss is that it is final. This situation is a lot more open-ended.
Well, there's just a basic principle that you can deal with what you know and not what you don't know. So one of the challenges that many people face today is wondering when it will end. And a lot of North Americans have trouble with waiting, if you will. You know, we have trouble waiting for the light to turn green, for the elevator to arrive. And so now when you're in liminal space and you're having to wait, it creates a lot of personal angst for many people. So you have to kind of surrender to your reality, or let go of control and be mindful about what you can do in a situation that you can't control. So as one European author said recently, as it relates to grief, the first thing you need to know about Americans is they think death is optional. Well, what's interesting right now is, in a culture where we have pretty, what I call, low levels of awareness of our mortality or high levels of assumed invulnerability, people are now more confronted with the reality that we're all mortal and that we die. And when that happens, you have a choice. You can either acknowledge that reality, or you can try to go around it or deny it, which is some of the behaviors you see reflected by people who don't want to believe there's a need for social distancing, which is really, of course, physical distancing and various other things. And that, again, interestingly, as we observe that, has to do with, you know, kind of a sociocultural issue of, are we willing to befriend and confront our mortality, or do we like to deny it? You know, there's a time for denial, but this is not a time for denial. This is a time to acknowledge the fact that this virus is real, and it's very easy to contract. And so you want to follow the guidelines that are out there, that are being provided, to take good care of yourself, not live in a state of denial.
What I'm hearing, though, and it was the second or third time you mentioned it, is that there are geographical differences in experiencing grief. I didn't realize that we as Americans, I guess, I don't want to say that we experience it poorly, but it sounds like we don't.
You can go ahead and say that.
Can I? I mean, it's, yeah. Like, what is the difference between the way
we study across cultures? North Americans are more likely to try to go around something than through it, and that's been influenced by a number of factors. We live in the world's first, for example, historically, what's called death-free generation, where many people now can live to 40 or 50, their parents are alive, maybe even their grandparents, so they come naked to the experience. We rapidly lost death symbols in our culture in the late 60s and 70s, where we started to move away from spending time with the body that had animated life, where we stopped sending flowers and as much food and various other things. We began to lose an understanding of the role of hurt and healing. The list goes on. When you see a convergence of those kinds of influences, you're set up where many people try to go around grief instead through it. But yet there's a basic principle that the only way to the other side of something is, in fact, through it. So the more we can acknowledge that and befriend it and move toward those, for example, six needs of mourning, of acknowledging it, befriending it, Still having gratitude, looking forward to the future, hope, and expectation of a good that is yet to be. All those things can help us survive this, because we will come out of darkness to light. But it's really tough for North Americans to do that, because we tend to try to live in a theme of don't worry, be happy. But right now, things are sad. I always say darkness is the chair upon which light sits. The more you can befriend the fact that we're in a period of darkness, the more we eventually will come to the light. But the more you try to be in light when you should be in dark, the more you fight against the realities that we're faced with. So yes, well, that was a long answer to your question, but I think there are cultural differences, and North Americans are notorious for trying to go around grief instead of through it. But right now they're faced with the very need to acknowledge their mortality, to take the precautions that are necessary, and do what we have to do to continue to have meaning and purpose in our life at the same time.
Regarding reaching out to others, you say that we were already in a loneliness epidemic before the coronavirus came along. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think there's an epidemic in North American culture of loneliness that while we don't want to overgeneralize that many people are over-isolated, particularly older adults in our society, where their cultures revere people as they grow older. We tend to be a youth-oriented culture, and we separate out younger generations from older generations to some extent. And the consequence right now of if you already take a baseline loneliness that many people exist and now they're forced to further isolate, it just creates kind of an epidemic of an existential loneliness, or what is the meaning and the purpose of life and living. And so I can't encourage people enough to reach out to those who are isolated, particularly isolated seniors, who, because of their higher risk right now, you've witnessed in the media people looking at them through windows. And I've had a number of calls to my Center for Loss with people who have parents in their life who have dementia, who don't understand why they're not being visited right now, and all sorts of things that relate to that sense of being alone and over-isolated. So staying in touch as much as possible, being consistent in that, is something you can do for particularly isolated seniors. But we do have a loneliness epidemic related specifically to your question. And if you know somebody out there as a listener that's a particular risk for loneliness, please, I encourage you to reach out to them and let them know that you're there for them.
You say that grief is transformative, and we're certainly collectively experiencing so much loss right now. How do you think we might see transformation as individuals or even as a society from this pandemic?
Let me, if I could, remind your listeners there that transformation means, in fact, an entire change in form. So when I hear people saying, oh, we're going to go back to the old normal, no, we're transformed. We're changed. We can come to reconcile ourselves to the reality. Reconcile means to make your life good again, and I can believe and have hope that that will occur. But you're going to learn some things about yourself in this process. I've already spoken to a number of people who've come to realize now that they've gone into neutral, for example, that they've been work addicted and that they need to slow down and spend more time with their family, that at the end of the day, it's not about all the material stuff we accumulate. It's about the relationships with our family and our friends. So I hope we're going to emerge from this viral and grief pandemic a more conscious, a more cohesive, a more caring world. I think we have the opportunity to do that, but we have to have a consciousness about it, not trying to rush back to the old normal, but say, what did we learn from this? Growth means enforced life learning. So we don't want to, in a pejorative way, say, oh, we're going to grow from this. It's growth we would have assumed bypassed, right? But by God, growth will occur if you allow yourself to befriend it and say, what am I taking away from this experience? What changes do I need to make in my day-to-day living? And one of the biggest I'm finding many people are becoming aware of is that some of the things society teaches us are most important. What car you drive, what neighborhood you live in. At bottom, it's really your relationships, and it's anchored in love. And so I guess that's what I would say, reflecting on that.
We've been talking to Alan Wolfelt, the director of the Center for Loss and Life Transition. Alan, thank you so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. Being a former Hoosier myself, growing up in the big city of Lafayette, it's an honor when the media reaches out to have me comment. So thank you very much, and wish my Hoosier friends well out there.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is on vacation next week, but we will encore some of our favorites, and we will have a new show for you next Wednesday on the personal finance lessons of the pandemic. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and enjoy the long weekend. This is All In.